The first few years of World War II, the campaign in Norway, operations in the North Sea, but particularly the developing cauldron of the Mediterranean, had showed both the strengths and the weaknesses of Axis anti-shipping strategy in Europe, at least in terms of air attack. Larger twin-engine bombers could go long distances and carry quite heavy payloads. But level-bombing ships was mostly turning out to be an exceptionally violent and risky way of reducing the local fish population. Big torpedo bombers tended to suffer horrific casualties, and when one of them went down, it took quite a few men with it. And while the Stuka was more accurate, it was still quite vulnerable as it trundled gently into the close range that it needed to deliver its payload, and was becoming even more vulnerable as various experiments saddled it with increasingly implausibly large bombs, sometimes having the effect of massively reducing its range and forcing even the questionable defence of the tail gunner to be abandoned. Thus, the Germans had stepped up development programmes that, to be fair, were already in motion, looking at some way of combining the accuracy of a human-guided close-range delivery system with the safety of not actually putting pilots and aircraft at that close range. This would result, after a number of other programs failing, in the production and deployment of two very different kinds of guided anti-shipping weapon, the Henschel HS-293 and the Ruhestahl SD-1400X, better known as the Fritz X. Today, we're going to take a brief look at the development, the capabilities, and the deployment of these two weapons, and how one of them came very close to managing to breach Warspite's plot armour. Starting with the HS-293. Now, a couple of years before the war, a number of companies had begun work on something that was called the Schwarz glider bomb. This had ended up failing for a number of reasons. As an unpowered glider, it was slow and thus quite vulnerable to anti-aircraft fire. Being smaller than an actual aircraft did help a bit, but it also lacked any form of agility, as there was just a rudimentary autopilot which was designed to keep it on a straight heading, which would be set by the launching crew, and that was pretty much its only guidance. It would just fly a fairly predictable, slow course which couldn't be changed after launch. So if the aim of the bombardier was off, or the target, you know, turned or changed speed, then the bomb would miss entirely. It really, at that point, would only serve to slightly increase the survivability of the bomber. It was also more of a technical exercise in actually creating the autopilot and working out the glider profile, as its aerodynamics in terms of control and drag were actually pretty awful. But in 1940, the German government, via the RLM, moved Professor Wagner to Henschel after he'd been fired from Junkers, not for composing glorious operas, but for having a rather eccentric and seemingly random work and research pattern, which resulted in him constantly missing deadlines. Henschel already had a team that was working on air-to-surface missiles, and they, between them, managed to corral Wagner into something approaching an organised workflow, giving him one of the abandoned Schwarz prototypes as a starting point. This quickly led to the development of the HS-293V1, which replaced the rudder and elevator control of the Schwarz with a fixed fin and control surfaces in the form of ailerons being instead mounted on the wings, as well as generally improving the body shape. But it was still a glider bomb, just a slightly better version of it. This was then further refined into the V2, which had a basic remote control system and was actually built in scale form and tested, whereas the V1 had only been a paper concept. The V2, in turn, led to the full-scale V3, which was test-launched at a 1 kilometre altitude, but the overall conclusion was that the speed issues of just being an unpowered glider bomb hadn't been solved. With no power, and with the projected launch platforms being relatively small themselves, they couldn't really increase much in terms of size or weight, and that in turn led to concerns over effectiveness, since the small warhead gently bumping into a ship wasn't thought to be likely to accomplish all that much. But With heavier bombers projected to come online, the HS-293A0 was developed in late 1940. This turned it from a pure glider bomb into something of a missile, as it had a Walter rocket motor attached to the underside, which of course gave it greatly increased speed, more freedom to manoeuvre, and the capacity to be dropped from just 400 metres of altitude, with the same range profile as the purely gliding version could get from 1,000 metres, which would allow the bombers to come in a little bit sneakier. Although initial problems with wiring and early electronic components meant that the first few tests failed rather spectacularly, the arrival of HE-177 prototype heavy bombers in 1941 allowed for successful testing to be conducted after the electrical system had been upgraded, at least when the bombers weren't setting themselves on fire. This created the HS-293A1, which, along with the A0, would become the first mass-production anti-shipping missile, with testing continuing even as the very first operational missiles were being shipped to frontline units. The missile was somewhat modular, with the warhead, radio receiver, rocket motor, and fuse all being built by separate companies, and then being shipped in individual crates, where they could be combined with the contents of a much larger crate, which was the main Henschel product, which consisted of the fuselage, wing, control surfaces, control and guidance system, and the batteries. Although later in production, the radio receiver would be incorporated into the control system directly, reducing the number of crates to 4. Each of these components would then be combined to create the final weapon. At just under 12 feet long and about 1.5 feet wide, the missile body was essentially a wrapper for the control equipment and an SC-500 bomb, which was a 500-kilo demolition bomb, which consisted of a fairly thin metal casing and a large explosive core that made up about 3/5 of the bomb's overall mass, which meant about 650 pounds of boom in an overall 1,110-pound bomb in imperial measurement terms. The wings were 10 feet wide, and all the control surfaces were made symmetrical in order to make control easier if the missile happened to flip upside down, as well as making mass production easier thanks to all the components being reasonably simple regular shapes. Since the bomb was high in explosive and low on steel, and the whole thing was fitted with an impact fuse that would go off instantly, it was judged that this weapon would be best used against merchant ships, auxiliaries, and small warships like sloops, corvettes, destroyers, and perhaps the occasional light cruiser. It was also found that the original white flares, which were used to help the controller see where the missile was and where it was going, were a bit too bright at close range and then paradoxically actually became quite hard to spot at longer ranges. It was found that red flares worked much better on both counts, but could lead to the missile being confused for a bit of tracer fire coming the other way when it got far away from the launch platform. This, and a rather disturbing dense smoke plume from the early flares that both gave away the launch and made spotting for control initially somewhat difficult, meant that there would be a constant effort to find an optimal solution for this throughout the missile's career. A small electrically powered light was available, but wasn't powerful enough to be spotted during the day, and thus could only be used in low light conditions. All-up weight of the HS-293 was almost exactly 1 metric ton after the rocket motor had been fueled up. Being a Walter engine, which used high-test hydrogen peroxide to produce high-pressure steam to provide thrust rather than a more traditional rocket engine as we might think of it normally, it provided this thrust for about 10 seconds. However, for a number of reasons, the engine proved unreliable, especially at altitude, and as you can imagine, the Luftwaffe ground crews were far from fond of the various incidents that high-test peroxide could cause if it wasn't stored perfectly. Eventually, this got so bad that 2 other rocket motors were proposed as competitors to replace it. And when your safer and more reliable options include words like fuming nitric acid in one case and let's see what happens if we combine methanol with pure oxygen and set it on fire in the other, the latter being the one they actually decided to go with, it gives you some idea of just how little the airborne Walter engine was loved by those on the front line. However, as it turned out, final deployment of these alternate rockets came far too late for any operational use, and so the Walter-engined HS-293 would be the one that was actually involved in all wartime operations. The controls for the missile had four options, besides just leaving it to go on its merry way. You could roll left, you could roll right, you could pitch up, and you could pitch down. As the commands were expressed as frequency modulations to the radio control wave, you had to give one command and then switch over to another to avoid confusing the control system. At least at first. When active commands weren't being issued, a gyro-controlled autopilot, a legacy of the Schwarz project, kept the missile going straight on its last commanded heading. An alternate wire-guided control option was also available, which had a theoretical range, based on the length of the wire, of 30 kilometres, which could be installed if it was thought that jamming might be a problem, although, to be fair, nobody ever launched these things from that kind of range. Similarly, the missile was theoretically limited by the just under 2 minute burn time of the flares, after which the operator would be very hard pressed to tell where it was, but as 2 minutes was about 3 to 4 times longer than the typical attack run from the time of launch, this burn time rarely, if ever, made an impact. The launch process, though, was a little complex. Firstly, the missile needed to be heated to improve battery efficiency, and flushed with that hot air to clear out condensation, which could be exceptionally dangerous when high-test peroxide is involved. The rest of the autopilot was then activated, and then the missile could be released. In most aircraft, the missile operator was on the right-hand side of the aircraft, and so it would have to fly somewhat to the left of the target so that the operator could keep the missile in view. Or they could perhaps orbit the target in a clockwise direction. There were a couple of interesting safety features also built in on launch. After release, the missile would not respond to any commands for the first second. This was to prevent unwitting collision by manoeuvring before full separation had been achieved. The rocket ignition was also activated remotely, not automatically when it was dropped, and so you could technically drop the missile like a glider bomb, and then activate the rocket later on in flight if you wanted to be really sneaky. A standard Luftwaffe-issue bomb aiming computer was slightly adapted, and this gave the missile operator something that would help him aim beyond just make bright light go in rough direction of target. But caution was needed, as aileron-only operation meant that particularly violent changes of course could, and sometimes did, send the missile tumbling out of control. Additionally, it was found that the maximum angle of dive was about 45 degrees, as any more than that, and the gyroscope that controlled the autopilot would topple off of its mount and control would again be lost. Three bombers were rated as HS-293 capable and actually used in combat, the Dornier 217, the HE-177, and the Focke Wulf 200. The HE-111 and a bunch of experimental bombers could also carry the missile, and the HE-111 was actually used in some tests, but it doesn't seem that any of these other aircraft were actually used to deploy them on the front lines. The first operational deployment of the HS-293 took place in late August 1943, when the 5th Escort Group, made up of 2 frigates, 3 corvettes and 2 sloops, a mixture of Royal Navy and Royal Canadian Navy forces, were patrolling off the northwest coast of Spain hunting for U-boats. 7 Junkers 88s armed with conventional bombs and a dozen Dornier 217s armed with HS-293s were dispatched to deal with them. Initially, thinking that a significant dive or level bombing attack was developing, the ships took appropriate evasive action, but the bomber group circled them rather serenely, and the escorts quickly got back into formation, somewhat bemused by this unusual behaviour. Then, the sloop HMS Langard spotted what seemed to be a small aircraft trailing smoke detach from one of the bombers and head right for them. The crew noted the relative bearing didn't change, which indicated that it was on a collision course. However, at almost the last minute, for reasons wholly unknown to anyone, it turned hard to starboard, fell out of the sky, and exploded about 300 feet away. Another similar object approached a few minutes later, this one in a gently continuing curve that landed it just over 100 feet away. 5 minutes after that, another object headed for them, and Langard's captain, having surmised that this was some kind of new weapon that also seemed to be getting closer and closer with each attempt, turned towards the incoming missile to present a smaller target. This caused the missile to overshoot, but the crew were then horrified to watch it turn back around towards them, only to then be relieved as the tightness of the turn caused it to stall out and crash, again landing about 100 feet away, with a third immense explosion as bits of shrapnel started to ping off of the sloop. Nearby, HMS Biddeford, the other sloop of the group, was somewhat less lucky as an explosion left one man killed and several injured, although sources conflict over whether this was a very near miss, with the blast and shrapnel coming aboard the ship at some speed and with considerable energy, or if the ship was actually physically struck, but the missile had a malfunctioning warhead. Either way, relatively little had been accomplished, and the other bombers soon withdrew. A couple of days later, though, on the 27th of August, the Germans were back. This time, 18 Dornier 217s came after the first support group, consisting of the destroyers HMCS Athabascan, as well as HMS Jed, Rotha, and Grenville, all commanded by the sloop Egret. Five of the bombers went for the largest target, the Athabascan, which dodged and weaved through incoming missiles until eventually one of them struck home. Some reports say possibly still with its rocket going. If so, that proved to be something of a miscalculation on the Germans' part, as although the strike was almost perfect, hitting the hull right below the bridge, the missile punched right through the destroyer and exploded shortly after emerging on the other side. This badly damaged the ship, but nowhere near as badly as if the demolition bomb had exploded inside it. As Athabascan coasted to a halt, trying to restart her boilers, Egret came under attack from no less than 7 missiles. 5 landed in the water in front of her, anti-aircraft fire downed a 6th, but the 7th slammed into her near the waterline, exploding in her aft magazine and blowing the ship apart, taking all but 28 of her 250-strong crew with her. HMS Egret thus had the dubious honour of being the first ship sunk by a guided anti-shipping missile. Despite the large hole in her side, Athabascan, with some help from Grenville, managed to get the fires under control and get underway. 2 more missiles detonated close by, but the shroud of smoke and steam that was gushing from the first impact made it somewhat hard to spot her, which likely explains the misses, since at this point she was stationary. She would eventually make it back to port, but the remaining ships of First Support Group were forced to withdraw, relieving pressure on the U-boats, which were trying to pass through the Bay of Biscay at the time. The rest of 1943 would see mixed success. One attempt at attacking Allied shipping was met by a formation of 3 French Spitfires that shot down most of the bombers involved before they could launch anything. Another attack in early November against a heavily guarded convoy mostly involved torpedo bombers, but a few missile-carrying Dornier 217s went after the destroyer USS Tilghman, which was forced to evade a series of increasingly closer and closer impacts, receiving minor damage from blast and shrapnel that at one point disabled her fire control system, but also forced the ship out of position, a gap in the defences which the torpedo bombers then exploited to help them sink another destroyer and a couple of transports. More definitive success was had in the Dodecanese Islands, where poor Allied coordination left the Luftwaffe with local air superiority. Although 2 destroyers were sunk fairly early in the campaign, these are now usually credited to Junkers 88s, but some sources still claim that a trio of Dornier 217s firing HS-293s were responsible. More certain, slightly later in the campaign, was the fatal damage inflicted on HMS Dulverton and the damaging beyond repair of HMS Rockwood, both of which were definitely credited to the HS-293, with the amusing side note that Rockwood took a hit to her frozen meat locker, which left the damage control crews very confused at first, since of course it meant that the site of the impact looked like a complete massacre, despite them having confirmed that only one man had actually been killed. In October, 20 Heinkel 177s managed to do what 30 U-boats had failed at and partially cracked the defences of the combined convoy SL-139-MKS-30. Although several missiles malfunctioned and the small steamer Marsa somehow managed to better Athabaskan's record by dodging no less than 8 missiles, another missile managed to hit her on the waterline and she would eventually sink, although with only one crewman lost. Another freighter was hit, but managed to make it back to port. It wasn't a brilliant showing, but it was still far more cost-effective than the Wolfpack had been, since, you know, they'd actually managed to sink something, although one of the HE-177s predictably lit itself on fire completely at random. The lack of greater success against the convoy was put down in part to the convoy's anti-aircraft defences, in particular the Prince Robert, a freighter-turned-armed merchant cruiser which had been liberally equipped with 4-inch anti-aircraft guns, and of all things, a Coastal Command Liberator, which had been helping see off U-boats, but upon sighting HE-177s burdened with a pair of HS-293s apiece, realised that they'd found the one thing in the sky that was possibly even less agile than they were. The pilot of the Liberator let the intrusive thoughts win, and the big bomber decided it was going to cosplay as the world's least plausible fighter aircraft, chasing down and engaging no less than 4 HE-177s, one after the other, forcing them to jettison their missiles and break off. Two of the German bombers, under the strain from the dogfight, decided to join their previous comrade in randomly setting themselves alight. Another attack on convoy KMF-26 sank a troopship, but at the cost of 6 aircraft shot down by escorting fighters and 3 more which crashed on landing, which forced the somewhat depleted bomber groups to try night attacks instead for a while, the idea being that some bombers would drop flares to give the others something to aim at. It was safer, but it was also relatively unsuccessful due to problems in coordinating the flare drops and the missile launches. Some of the odd behaviour of the missiles at this stage of proceedings, well before Allied jamming efforts, may have been down to sabotage. The Henschel works used extensive slave labour who understandably weren't entirely thrilled with their job prospects, and later investigations found that somebody with a degree of electrical knowledge had cleverly sabotaged a number of missiles which were examined. What they'd done was cut a guidance system control wire and then wrapped the two wire ends back around each other. This meant that in ground testing, the circuit was complete and the missile would test normally. But in flight, either due to vibration from the aircraft or vibration from the missile's acceleration, the wire would eventually be shaken loose, and then the guidance system would, of course, suddenly fail, sometimes spectacularly. Various Allied countermeasures were also adopted. If a ship was free to manoeuvre while under HS-293 attack, they were instructed to turn into the attack, which presented a smaller and thus more difficult target, while anti-aircraft guns were instructed to fire on the missiles once they were launched, rather than continuing to attack the launch platforms. While the HS-293 was small and relatively swift, it also tended to dodge somewhat less than a manned aircraft. Various jamming efforts were also tried, just broadcasting very loudly on multiple frequencies at full power, although the number of frequencies available to the missile's control system meant that wildly guessing what frequency to jam was somewhat ineffective, and even if you got a continuous jamming signal onto that frequency, because the controls were looking for a change in modulation rather than specific coded instructions, as long as the signal wasn't too overpowering, you could still control the missile. Here, though, there is plenty of conflict in primary sources. Many Allied sources thought that their jamming efforts were quite effective, whereas most German sources disagree. There is, of course, the famous oft-cited example of electric razors somehow providing an effective shield, but on closer examination, while these accounts are based in reality and appear in multiple reports, it seems that the key to this trick was not to have everybody standing around on deck waving an active electric razor like you're at an especially militant rock concert, but rather using the unshielded oscillating motor and the varying electromagnetic field it gave off of the typical 1940s razor as a source of random multi-frequency electrical noise, which the ship's transmitters could then broadcast and was more effective in blanketing a wider part of the electronic spectrum with random noise. Or at least that's what some of the ship's reports indicate. A combination of more successful jamming efforts over time, increasing Allied anti-aircraft strength and fighter cover, as well as decreasing German bomber strength, meant that the Allied landings in Sicily and Italy would be the last time significant success would be scored with the HS-293, with a number of transport ships and a few warships hit, although at great cost to the bombers in question. The single biggest warship sunk would be the Dido-class light cruiser HMS Spartan, which was hit in her boiler rooms off Anzio, the HS-293's greatest battlefield. The last successful HS-293 attack of the war, with limited value thereof, took place in late July 1944 when the frigate HMCS Matane, or Matane possibly, was hit by a missile that passed through the aft superstructure and detonated in the water alongside. Although damaged, the Matane was towed into port, with four crew killed. But by this point, the Allied advances in France were becoming more of a priority for German high command than what the Allies were doing at sea, and a couple of weeks after the attack on the Matane, you have the first recorded use of HS-293s against land targets. This involved an attack on a bridge that, if collapsed, would hamper the Allied advance out of the Cherbourg Peninsula. The attack got a few near misses, but it was badly disrupted when radar-equipped Mosquito showed up and started attacking the bombers, despite them operating under the cover of night. As Dornier 217 production had ended in 1944, the HE-177s had largely attritioned themselves out of service, and the Focke-Wulf 200 force, never large, was practically spent, attacks with HS-293s became more and more sporadic, often mixed into composite units that also included regular bombers and the Mistel combination bombers, with the last known combat use of the missile being an attack that managed to destroy some bridges over the Oder River in April 1945. That brings us to the other guided bomb, the Rohrstahl SD-1400X, or Fritz X for short. Like the HS-293, the Fritz X technically has its origins in pre-war programs, in this case various experiments in 1938 that attached basic control surfaces to the tail of a 250-kilo bomb. This system seemed to work relatively well in allowing a high-altitude release, with the bombardier then adjusting the bomb's course as it fell. By 1940, there was enough interest in this project and enough irritation at the general uselessness of level bombing in anti-shipping roles to cause the Germans to adopt the guidance package, but to put it on a much larger weapon, both for increased effectiveness against armoured targets and also because the complexity of the technology and the effort involved that would go into producing each weapon necessitated the largest possible payback per drop. For this purpose, the PC-1400 armour-piercing bomb was selected. This was a 1.4-tonne or 3,100-pound heavy armour-piercing bomb that could only be carried by larger multi-engine bombers. And yes, someone did try and get one under a Stuka. No, it didn't end well. A number of changes were made to the bomb. To increase speed of fall, a more streamlined nose was fitted. Four fixed stabilising fins were fitted around the body, and the original tail was removed completely and replaced by a tapering cylinder, in which was stored the control system and the radio equipment, and a much larger cowled rudder and elevator were set right at the back, which would be the only external moving elements, as on the elevator and rudder were the control surfaces. Like the HS-293, there were four control commands, but as this was a otherwise free-falling bomb, the fixed fins were offering more stability than lift, although they did offer a modicum of glide performance, at least at the first. The commands were simply up, down, left, and right. Early testing, starting at the beginning of 1942, revealed some fairly predictable factors: a minimum drop altitude of 4,000 metres to give enough time to adjust the bomb's flight path, the unsurprising need for clear weather so that you could spot it all the way down, and various things like this. but also the news that the designers had actually done too good of a job with the improved aerodynamics. The bomb fell so quickly that bombardiers had a hard time keeping an eye on it, and the controls tended to jam once it had reached terminal velocity. A small air brake thus had to be added to the tail, which slowed the bomb back down just enough to be controllable and trackable, with a flare added to the tail to help with the tracking. The whole weapon now weighed just under 1.6 tonnes, or just under 3,500 pounds, and early tests managed to achieve a hit rate of just over 50% against a battleship-shaped target in less than a month. The hit rate actually went up further if you approach the ship from the bow or stern, as opposed to broadside on. The control surfaces, or more correctly, the spoilers that were mounted to the fins, totaled six, two vertical and two horizontal, which were used for guidance, and another pair, which shared the horizontal fin, which were actuated by the gyroscope aboard to stop the bomb from rolling generally. Like the HS-293, there was a wire-guided control option, this one with a mere 8 kilometres of wire, and this could be installed if it was felt that jamming might be a problem. As a mostly gravity bomb, the launching aircraft had to be linearly considerably closer than an HS-293 launcher, but it could fly, and in fact had to fly, somewhat higher. Conversely, it also had to fly slower. The bomber actually had to slow down quite considerably after dropping the bomb so as not to overshoot the target, because that would make the bombardier lose his sight on the bomb in the vital last few moments of approach. It was found that a gentle climb after release brought the speed down quickly enough, as well as buying a bit more altitude for safety. The drop still had to be vaguely on target rather than just thrown off into the ether, as the maximum amount by which the bomb could be redirected was about 500 metres forward or backward, and about 175 metres to either side. A special camera was tied into the release system and mounted on the launching aircraft, which took photos of the bomb at regular points on its way down for later evaluation. By March 1943, final testing had been completed and the bombs began to be shipped to frontline units. These arrived in one large, particularly heavy crate, with the body fins and the radio controller dismounted and tucked into separate boxes inside, so some assembly was required. Like the HS-293, the preferred launch platform was the Dornier 217, specifically the high-altitude K2 variant, which also had a larger bombardier section in the nose. Theoretically, the aircraft could carry two bombs, but the weight and drag penalty was such that in operational conditions they usually flew with one and a fuel tank on the other pylon. The first attacks were launched in August 1943, targeting Sicilian ports captured by the Allies. However, these initial attacks failed to do any damage and the Allies didn't notice that they were being targeted by guided bombs, they just thought they were regular bombs. But in early September, the Italian armistice saw the three Littorio-class battleships, along with six cruisers and eight destroyers, head out to sea to try and join up with other units of the Regia Marina, all on their way to Malta. Without air cover of their own in the form of carriers, the Allied air forces somewhat occupied supporting the landings, although they had technically promised air cover, and Regia Aeronautica airfields either standing down or in the process of being overrun by German troops, the fleet was thus left without any air cover. Alerted by code breaking to the fleet's movements, Kampfgeschwader 100's Dornier 217s rushed to chase them. Seeing five German bombers coming in at high altitude, as the Italians hadn't been briefed on this new weapon, the Regia Marina formation increased speed and prepared to take evasive action. But a small contingent of level bombers at 20,000 feet wasn't thought to be an entirely unsolvable problem, even without air cover, given the general inaccuracy of such attacks. And indeed, although the explosions were spectacular, the first wave of bombs threw up a lot of water and not much else. Unfortunately, with everybody taking their own evasive action, it made overlapping anti-aircraft fire considerably more difficult to pull off as the fleet formation began to break up, and soon the flagship, Roma, was hit by a Fritz X from the second wave of bombers, which crippled her. And then as she slowed, another Fritz X hit her, which compounded issues somewhat by partially detonating one of the forward main magazines, along with other damage. However, even in this first successful engagement, the Fritz X had been almost too effective. Although crippling, the first hit seems to have just gone right through the Roma, detonating underwater rather than inside. The Italia, formerly the Littorio, was also hit, although whether this was a hit and then a near miss, or two hits, remains disputed between accounts. In any case, here, the two Fritz X's overperformed as well. With both impacts being near the extreme ends of the ship, the bomb, or bombs, just went right through into the sea and exploded some distance underwater, allowing the damaged Italia to make it to Malta. With this success under their belt, Kampfgeschwader 100 soon had a captive audience as the Allied fleets appeared off Salerno. The USS Philadelphia would be the first to be damaged by a near miss in this campaign. Nearby, the cruiser USS Savannah had been waiting for a shore bombardment call when her sister ship was damaged. Savannah then picked up speed, but was soon hit herself. This time, the hit's precise location was again what saved her, but in the opposite way to Italia. This hit, unlike those on the Italia, which had punched straight through lightweight plating, landed squarely on the roof of turret 3. As the roof was armoured, this of course immediately initiated the fuse, as well as slowing the bomb somewhat, and that meant that when the bomb exploded, it exploded in the lower handling room of the turret. Now, that wasn't great. The explosion killed everybody in the turret, as well as an entire damage control team who were nearby, and poisonous fumes got most of the people in the adjacent turret, but the bomb exploded relatively high in the ship instead of deep in her belly. That isn't to say it was all good, though. Blast and fragments ripped down through the ship, tearing a hole in the bottom of the ship at the keel and opening up a seam on her port side. The boiler fires were also blown out, and she was briefly without power until the boiler crews got things started again. Damage control crews rushed to isolate the flooding, and she just about managed to bring the water levels under control. With power restored, she limped away to Malta, and she'd be out of action for about a year. 3 days later, it was the turn of HMS Uganda, and this time it was almost a repeat of Italia, with the direct hit passing right through the ship and exploding under the keel. The cruiser was crippled, and would again need about a year to repair, but she survived. Further attacks only managed to score a number of damaging near misses, and the only other loss for a couple of days was the SS Bushrod Washington, a Liberty ship that was full of gasoline, which rather predictably burned to the waterline once she was hit. But then on the 15th of September, HMS Warspite was making her way along at 10 knots, the maximum that was possible in the crowded seas off the beaches, heading for a shore bombardment mission, when she was swarmed by a dozen FW-190 fighter bombers. This attack amounted to not a huge amount, but it was a distraction, for when lookouts took stock of the airspace beyond the FW-190s again as they retreated, they saw what they believed to be three aircraft overhead. In fact, they were a trio of Fritz X's on their way down, having been dropped in almost a textbook exercise formation, since of course Warspite's anti-aircraft guns hadn't been engaging the bombers, and at this point they were already passing through 6,000 feet and accelerating on their way down. Warspite's captain later recalled that there was only about 7 to 10 seconds between spotting the bombs and their impact, which was nowhere near enough time for a ship at 10 knots, or at almost any speed really, to do all that much of anything about the issue other than brace for impact. One bomb missed, another scored a near miss, which opened up the starboard torpedo bulges, but the last one landed near the funnel, punching through every deck and piece of armour on its way, and exploded in number 4 boiler room, blowing a large hole in the underside of the ship. For the first time since the fatal hit on Roma, the bomb had worked perfectly as intended. The attack, somehow, only managed to kill 9 people and wounded 14, and the 20-foot hole in the hull quickly extinguished any fires that might otherwise have spread to her magazines. It was damage that would have sunk almost any ship. Indeed, by all rights, it should have sunk her. But this was Warspite, and after sitting dead in the water for a time, she rallied, restored partial power, and was then taken in tow for Malta, surviving by the skin of her teeth, and, well, the tow is a whole story in and of itself. After this, increasing levels of Allied air cover made further attacks fruitless. Poor old Philadelphia reported a third near miss on the 18th, but then that was it for those landings. Kampfgeschwader 100 would be back in action soon, though, as the landings at Anzio kicked off, and here the destroyer HMS Janus had her bows blown clean away. But channeling the spirit of HMS Eskimo, she declared that this was merely a flesh wound and sailed off under her own power, having suffered no casualties, and picked up a new bow at Gibraltar. Other ships were hit, some were damaged, others, particularly heavily loaded Liberty ships, were lost, and the Allies deployed jammers, smoke screens, and forward-placed fighter control teams and radio interception units, and to a degree, these measures were able to disrupt further attacks. It wasn't 100% successful, partially unloaded ammunition ship was hit with rather predictable results, but losses among KG-100's aircraft were mounting, and the unit had to be withdrawn to rebuild. It was briefly considered to try and redeploy some of the unit against the Arctic convoys, which were slightly less heavily defended, but somehow their entire consignment of Fritz X's vanished during the transit to Norway. By spring 1944, it was decided to try and use the weapons on ships in Allied home harbours, utilising night attacks. This included a raid on Plymouth, which targeted the battleship King George V. Flare-dropping aircraft, meant to highlight the target, arrived a bit late, and by the time the place was illuminated, the Luftwaffe pilots reported a low-level haze that meant they couldn't actually see the battleship at all, and so the mission was aborted, with two of the Kampfgeschwader 100 aircraft being shot down by the defences. The haze was actually a smoke screen deployed over the harbour, much like the Germans deployed smoke around Tirpitz in Norway, and it had been started when the German raiders had first been spotted on radar. The late arrival of the flare droppers had allowed it to thicken. The next big idea was to fit a homing device onto a Fritz X, which would then automatically guide the bomb towards a source of strong radio signals. The plan here was to use them on the Allied radio navigation beacons that were guiding the Allied bomber offensives over Germany at night. But then the D-Day landings occurred before this version of the Fritz X could be operationally deployed. And by summer 1944, the more pressing need for tactical air support, along with a growing fuel crisis, saw KG-100 disbanded, and with it went the operational use of the Fritz X. Several variants had been developed along the way before production stopped, mainly looking at improving aerodynamics once again, since stronger control surfaces had become available. This in turn would allow for even higher and thus safer drop altitudes, with the last prototype versions of the Fritz X being considerably heavier and theoretically capable of being dropped at speeds of around or possibly just above Mach 1 while still remaining under control. But it doesn't seem that these late variants saw any operational use. And thus ended the careers of Germany's two major anti-ship guided air-launched weapons. They left behind two main legacies. Firstly, in keeping with many German projects, they were taken away and analysed by the Allies post-war to see if they offered anything new compared to their own guided bomb and missile programmes at the start of the Cold War. And secondly, there's been a prolonged, and in some circles still ongoing, debate over which weapon precisely hit which ship, especially during the Sicily and Italy campaigns, where both Fritz X and HS-293 were being used liberally at the same time. And some ships, traditionally thought to have been hit by one, have later turned out to be hit by the other. HMS Spartan, for example, has long been credited to being a victim of the Fritz X, but the latest research now appears to show that she was actually hit by an HS-293. But that's it for now. Thank you very much for listening. See you again in another video.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.